This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo, case 25. The Master's Portrait. The main case. Zen Master Guichen of Dijang Monastery held a memorial service for his teacher, Zhuangxia. He invited Baoen and served him the evening meal. When Baoen looked at the altar, there was no picture of Master Zhuangxia, so he asked, "Do you have a portrait of your master?" Dijang folded his hands, bowed, and said, "Look." Baoen said, "There is no picture." Dijang said, "It's clear that you don't see it, but it's here." The commentary. Understanding it before a word is spoken is called silent discourse. Revealing it spontaneously without explanation is called hidden activity. Alas, although Baoen is served a lavish meal by Dijang, he still goes away hungry. Aside from words and ideas, people often don't understand the truth of the Buddha Dharma. Mind to mind, Zhuangxia and Dijang have sealed each other. Buddha to Buddha, the lamp passed from generation to generation. If you have not as yet seen clearly into this matter, then listen to the sound of the cold wind in the pine trees. Look at the autumn mountains of green and gold. When you really see it, it is clearly not like something. The verse. The transmission of the way is not to be found in following after others. If you want to know the truth of the universe, see that the reality of ignorance is no other than Buddha nature, and the illusory form is itself the pure Dharmakaya. For those of you who may not know this, this collection of koans Master Dogen brought back from China when he went to China and studied with Chuching. It's said that he stayed up his final night before he left to return back to Japan copying these koans, and so he just copied the koans themselves, just the case koans, and brought them back and then used quite a number of them as sort of seeds for his Shobogenzo teachings. And so many years ago, Dada Roshi began working with Kaz Tanahashi translating these cases. And then he, and that went on for quite a number of years. Every time that Kaz was here to lead a retreat, they would spend time doing translation work and also, you know, via correspondence. And then over a period of quite a number of years, Dada Roshi gave talks on all of these koans, which is where the commentary and the verses came from. So these are all done by him and the footnotes. And I remember towards the end of that process, it went on a long time. I mean, it was really an incredible amount of work that he... that they both put into it, and Dada Roshi in particular in terms of, you know, the commentary and the verse, but then giving a teisho on each and every one of these. And so it's really, I think, an incredible gift to us, a legacy to go along with the collections that have come down to us that we, you know, that are a long-standing part of the koan tradition. And I remember towards the end of that whole process, when he was in the last, you know, bunches of koans, that he admitted at one point that these were sort of the bottom of the barrel. You know, the ones that didn't really interest him that much, or he didn't think were necessarily great koans, but, you know, they were part of it, so he kind of had to do it. This was not one of those. Dada Roshi used to talk a lot about, I'm thinking of him, or this mountains and river Sesshin, many years ago, began as a Sesshin that was just for students. It was the one Sesshin a year when we tried to just have formal students here, which never quite worked out because we always had people in residence who were not formal students. And then over the years, that just fell away. But the mountains and rivers, you know, order, but that coming from also the Mountains and Rivers Sutra. And so in the fall, I always think of him, and also we're coming around to the anniversary of his death next month. In fact, I was just thinking about this. Some of us are leaving for this pilgrimage to India on the anniversary of his death, and I thought, I should have checked that out and seen whether that was auspicious or inauspicious. I'm not quite sure. I guess we'll see. But he used to talk a lot about the subtleties of training, the subtleties of the teachings. And here in the beginning of the commentary, he points kind of to that. Understanding it before a word is spoken is called silent discourse. Revealing it spontaneously without explanation is called hidden activity. And this is a really important part of traditional Zen training. And it's an aspect of the training that can easily get lost because its very nature is subtle. And which means, you know, by definition, that oftentimes it will go unnoticed, which means effectively for that person it didn't happen. And so nothing happens in that, and nothing has been communicated or received. And yet when it is received, it's very powerful. You know, if you think of one end of the spectrum of having something, you know, something explained to you in great detail, you know, in a kind of linear fashion. And so you have that explanation, but it's kind of dead, right? Because the life of it's all been given out in the explanation. So in a sense, there's nothing for you to do. Whereas the way the teachings are communicated and conveyed and received is not like that. I mean, even Zazen, which we give instruction in a somewhat linear fashion to help new students remember, you know, the instructions. Once you start sitting, you realize this is not a linear process. This is not just a matter of, you know, like seeing the recipe for a cake and you just do one, you know, you do the first thing, the second thing, the third thing. It's not like that. And so right away we realize we're in a different kind of terrain. And it's, you know, those subtleties are also subject to loss because we like to have things explained. I mean, it's not uncommon for students to get annoyed or angry because things have not been explained sufficiently. And sometimes things do need to be explained, right? There is that. I mean, we don't just say, okay, your position is the Doan, intuit it. I mean, we do give instruction. But even then, you know, and it comes down to what happens, you know, face-to-face in training, but even then you can't say it all. There is much that has to be felt, particularly when you're striking an instrument. You know, you can't quantify that. You can't package that. You can't tell someone how to do that, right? They have to experience that. They have to be in an intimate contact with that instrument. And this has everything to do with how we meet the Dharma, how we meet the teachings, how we meet a teacher, how we meet the self. It has everything to do with it because it is intimate. You know, when you're standing across the field and you want to get somebody's attention, you have to shout. But when you're standing very close to them, a whisper is sufficient. How is it when you're standing inside? And so subtle communication, subtly conveying the teachings, in essence, is always how it's happening. which means that there will be many times where it's being conveyed and not received, which is one reason why there's so much repetition. You know, we hear something over and over and over, and we hear the words, you know. We see the teacher's mouth moving. We hear the words, we understand them to some extent, but nothing is really being, like there's a gap. There's a bridge that's not being crossed. Until one day we hear it in a different way. It penetrates, it pierces. Something happens within us. And that is beyond description, beyond communication. That can't be given, can't be conveyed. It's beyond meaning and understanding, and yet you know. You know. And you know within your sentient beingness, right? That's what you have this body for, and these senses, is to come alive in such moments. And so, in our training, we bow to the Buddha. We bow to Avalokiteshvara and Prajnaparamita. We bow to a medicine Buddha and an earth witness Buddha. We bow to Amitabha Buddha. I bow every morning to my teacher. Good morning, teacher. At Aheiji, when I was there last two springs ago, we were walking around and they told me that every morning there's a monk who is given the responsibility of waking up very early and creating a fire, building a fire, going down to the spring, collecting water, coming back up, heating up the water, and making a cup of tea for Dogen, who died in 1253. But every morning is served a cup of tea. And that position is considered a position of great importance. The teachings speak of the importance of faith and patience and generosity, forbearance, respect, offered to the Buddha, offered to the ancestors, offered to our living teachers, offered to the Dharma and the Sangha. Who is this for? Who is it for? How is this essential on the path of liberation? If the whole of the Buddha Dharma, that is Buddha Dharma, is a path of liberation, that's it, folks. That's the mission. It's not to have buildings. It's not to, you know, follow rules and regulations. It's not to have magazines. It's not to be cool. It's a path of liberation. So how is all of that essential to that path? We should wonder. You know, when I first entered into training and I encountered so many different things that I hadn't, I mean, all I basically had known up to that point was meditation and reading. And a very little bit of reading, because there wasn't very little written. And so when I encountered liturgy and services and art practice and body practice and the precepts, you know, and there were many times where I thought, how is this essential to the path of liberation? Why not just sit? Right? That seemed to be sort of the central focus. And on a certain level, I got that somehow. That made sense to me. What about all these other forms of practice? There have been a number of questions about liturgy this week. And liturgy, I think, you know, let's think, understand this as being more than just services. Liturgy occurs within the context of a service, but liturgy is much larger than that. Mudra Roshi spoke of making visible the invisible. What kind of magic is this? Making visible the invisible. We do it all the time. When you make love visible, you can't weigh it. You can't put it on a shelf. You can't sell it to somebody. But you can make it visible. You can express what is fundamentally inexpressible, even though we express it and try to express it in so many different ways. Why? It's like making intimate contact with something you can't possess, or understanding what you can't know. In the Gateless Gate, there's a poem that says, it's far better to see the face than to hear the name. We have names for everything. It's far better to see the face. But what face are we talking about? Having faith in Buddha nature is having faith in that which from which all things arise. Bodhicitta, practice, realization, integration. And within all the various schools of Buddhism and all the various lineages, it really always comes down to the same thing. How do you have an intimate encounter with the Dharma? With yourself, with the world, with every phenomenal thing. How do you face the teacher? What is the teacher? You know, before Seishin, we all have to make preparations, even those of us who live here. We have to prepare. You know, get our work in order, because we're not going to be working much the next week. During the week of Seishin, clean up our spaces, right? You clean up your spaces, residents. We prepare. Those of you who don't live here certainly have to prepare. Put your things in order. Get people to help fill in the gaps that you're going to create by not being there. It takes a lot of people, actually, to allow us to sit here. But what about the internal preparations? And not just for Seishin, but for facing what's real. You know, we don't always, in our culture, because we're so, sort of everything's such a commodity. You know, we just think, well, if I give you something, I can get something back, we're good, right? That's it. This is not that. In a sense, we have to prepare. In a sense, you could say practice is nothing but an ongoing preparation for that very thing. That preparation and fulfillment occurs in one moment. Dogen says, actualizing Buddha ancestors means to bring them forth and look at them in veneration. How is this preparing us to encounter the Dharma, to see Buddha? And how is it the fulfillment of that? You know, as I was working on this, I thought what came to mind was improbable me. That's what came to mind, improbable me. When I was reflecting on veneration and faith. I mean, if you told me decades ago that I'd be sitting here talking about veneration, I would say, what have you been drinking? That was not in my vocabulary. And I didn't really, you know, like people who talked about that kind of stuff. I held that in high suspicion. What do you mean, venerate? When we set up the teachings, we establish training, there's always the potential, not even the potential, the inevitability for bringing forth false views and attachments. If we don't set up the teaching and don't establish the training, false views and attachments are already present. When you make one stroke, say one word, offer one subtle gesture, already those false views and attachments have the potential to spring forth. And so we need to understand what we're venerating. We need to understand what we're turning towards. To have a Buddha image, to have an image of Kenon, for Mahapajapati to be sitting on an altar. How do we turn towards and develop faith in, cultivate reverence for wisdom? You can't touch it. You can't see it. How do you turn towards and cultivate faith in awakening, enlightened nature, selfless compassion, non-duality? These are words. How do you bring them to life? The word for altar in Latin means to is something for sacrifice for the gods. And there are quite a number of sutras where the Buddha makes it very clear that the sacrifice of any living creature is creating suffering. And you don't end suffering by creating suffering. So he wanted nothing to do with that. When we establish an important altar, a main altar, we do an eye-opening ceremony. And this isn't just in the Zen tradition. It's in other traditions, Buddhist traditions too. And so that we have an image that is originally made of wood or stone or metal. And in the eye-opening ceremony, the eyes are opened, including the third eye, which is one of the, you know, that we talk about the hara in Chinese, the tan tian, and there's one here below the navel that we ground ourselves in zazen, there's one in the heart region, and there's one here. And so we open all the eyes. And the poem that's given, which is an invocation, as a teaching of that image, specific to that image, is then stored within the Buddha or the image itself. What is that about? To bring forth and make live Buddha, Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, so that it's a living thing. So what does that mean? What is a living thing? Living where? When you see something, a stone, a tree, a cloud, you wouldn't think of a cloud as a living thing or a stone as a living thing, but when it moves you, shifts something in your consciousness, something is living. Something is alive. Where is that taking place? To actualize Buddha ancestors is to actualize Buddha. To bring them forth and look at them in veneration, Dogen says. And so this is dangerous ground, right? We should recognize that. The Buddha said it's one of the greatest forms of attachment to attach to ideas, to turn away from the self and attach to things outside of the self, to put something above, to put something below. And so what does it mean to truly venerate? Right? That rather than creating more delusion, creating a self, creating high and low, is enlightening those false views. And who is this for? Again, why? That when we bow to the Buddha, is that for the Buddha? When we bow to our teacher, is that for the teacher? When we serve, hold in respect, is that for somebody else? When a Sangha has faith, practices within faith, when a Sangha has respect, a sense of dignity, when a Sangha has patience, that's only because people, practitioners, are bringing forth those enlightened qualities within themselves. And when they do that, when you do that, that transforms you. It opens the door to the inner gate, to the inner chamber. It liberates suffering. It brings loving kindness out. Now the teachings can be offered. Now the teachings can be received. When we say, when it's said that when the student is ready, the teacher appears, that's what that means. It's not when you decide you're ready. Okay, I'm ready now. Bring it on. That's not necessarily being ready. Sometimes we're ready and we don't even know it. And for those things, those enlightened qualities to be arising, the rational thinking, organizing, ordering, controlling, domesticating mind has to relax. Right? That part of our mind works way too hard. That's why when you're feeling really exhausted, check into that. Sometimes it's just we have been working way too hard. Student and teacher liberate each other. The Sangha and the world intermingle in compassion and wisdom. And Dogen says this isn't limited to Buddhas of the past, present, and future, but it is going beyond Buddhas who are going beyond themselves. Wisdom beyond wisdom. Going beyond Buddha. Going beyond themselves, ceaselessly. Every self, every Buddha. And so to venerate Buddha means when you meet the Buddha on the road, you kill the Buddha. Right? A startling imperative. To not establish something as veneration. But in not producing, there's veneration. And so, when Bowen is visiting Dzhang's monastery for memorial service for his teacher, Zhuangzi, he says, he looks at the altar, there's no portrait. Right? Like when we do a memorial service, we put a portrait of the person on the altar to bring that person for the sense of that person, invoke them into our presence. And there was no portrait. And so he says, don't you have a portrait of your master? And Dzhang folded his hands and bowed. He said, look. And Bowen, yeah, but there's no picture on the altar. Dzhang said, I understand that you don't see it, but it's here. He said, just because you don't see it doesn't mean that others don't. Just because you don't see it in this moment doesn't mean that you won't in another moment. Where's the face of the master? Bowen couldn't see it. He was looking for an image. He was looking for something he recognized, something familiar. Something he could relate to. The commentary, Dhararoshi says, mind to mind, Zhuangzi and Dzhang have sealed each other, Buddha to Buddha. The lamp passes from generation to generation. This is the subtle communication. The other day I quoted Dogen speaking about the transmission of Zazen. So you receive the instructions. That's not Zazen yet. You sit down to do Zazen and you try and figure it out. That's not yet Zazen. But it's a beginning. That what each of us is in the midst of is a transmission, a conveyance, an intimate conveyance of something that cannot be told. And in our world where we're being told everything, everywhere, all the time, stop, please. There's another way. There is more than information that needs to be conveyed. Zhuangzi and Dizhang have sealed each other. It's always like this. This is what's happening in Taisho. It's what's happening in Doksan and Daisan. It's what's happening in practicing together. When we speak of body teaching, that means not describing. You know, when I see a student in a new position, right, or a chief disciple in a new position, right, and I see something that's not, you know, isn't yet, hasn't been received. You know, sometimes it's important just to wait and see. Will they notice? And you could say, you know, when you tell somebody, it's like, oh, okay, I get it now. And that's okay. But then it just really sits on the surface. And also we're training ourselves to wait for that. And really what we're training in is an eyeball that is nothing but your whole body and mind. An awareness that is nothing but each moment. That looking in and looking out are the same. That seeing in front of you and behind you happens simultaneously. Know that fundamentally you don't lack unsurpassed enlightenment. You are replete with it continuously. That's what's happening when we are pierced. That which is already present is made contact. We come into contact. It's not coming from the outside. Something is happening. We are in dynamic relation with something. But that moment of shift is already there. Just as in the same way that when we get angry, the only reason we can get angry in a certain moment is because the seeds of anger are already there. If they're not there, anger can't arise. It doesn't come from nothing. And it doesn't come from you. My anger doesn't come from you. It has to already be present within me. So too awakening. So too generosity. So too loving kindness. We're not making this stuff up. We're not creating it for the first time. We're not manufacturing enlightened virtues. Awakening is really a beautiful way of expressing it. You're completely there. Come. Rise. And this trust, this veneration, one of the dangers is, as I touched on the other day, was abdication, that we abdicate, you know, a kind of blind faith, right? Just tell me what to do. I mean, don't people, us, on a certain level love that? Just tell me what to do, right? I'm not getting it. It would make it so much easier. Maybe. For about 5 seconds. I remember, you know, in that tension between veneration, trust, you know, opening, making ourselves vulnerable to the Dharma, to the teaching, asking, right? When we become students, we bow. That's a real thing. We ask for the teachings. That's not a formula. And that doesn't just happen once. That needs to happen over and over and over. I mean, I hope it's happening for you every day. That's a good way to wake up. Wake up and ask for the teachings, and then smell the coffee. Ask. Ask who? Just ask. I was thinking about in the Million Dollar Baby, that movie with Clint Eastwood and Hilary Swank, where she's a boxer. He's an old crusty boxing coach. And at one point, he's talking about training boxers. And he says, they have big egos, right? Anybody who's going to be a boxer has got to have a big ego. And so as their trainer, he says, you have to break them down and break them down and break down that ego, right? So that you can train them, so that they can cultivate their potential. Right? As long as that ego is in charge, they can't do that. He says, but, he says, if you take out all of the fight, they're no good. They're done, finished. You have to leave some fight in them. Students of the Dharma is like that too. Right? That fight is spirit. That fight is, it's you. It's yours. It's your responsibility. It's my responsibility. And that is an incredibly powerful dynamic, right? That open, vulnerable, surrendering trust, asking for the teachings, and standing on your own two feet, occupying your seat. Dogen says, at the time of bowing formally to Shakyamuni Buddha's face, the 51 Buddha ancestors and the 7 original Buddhas are not present side by side or in a line. They're not congregated. But it is face-to-face transmission among all the Buddha ancestors at the same time, in the same place. Masters and disciples always see one another when transmitting and receiving the Dharma. We see each other. This is the realization of the way. Thus, masters and disciples bring forth the luminous face of the Buddha. Bowen was looking for. He would have been satisfied with an ordinary face, a picture of someone. Dijang was not going along with this. He showed it to him directly, folded his hands and bowed. Look. And Bowen still didn't see it. But there's no picture, he said. Dijang said, yes, there is. You just don't see it yet. Yet. Dogen said, it's like pouring water into the ocean and spreading it endlessly, or like transmitting the lamp and allowing it to shine forever. And this is not the image of taking one lamp and lighting another. You have a lamp. The teacher has a lamp. The teacher gives you the flame. It's not like that. It's one light, one lamp. It burns continuously. Ultimately, even when there's no realization, it's still burning. They're still sealing each other. Because from the very beginning, you are replete. And so when we raise the image on the altar, where a teacher sits on a platform, it has nothing to do with higher and lower. It has to do with seeing the Dharma appearing in a Buddha image, appearing in a teacher, appearing in a stick. Like pouring water into the ocean and spreading it endlessly. What a beautiful image. Right? That's what we're doing, pouring water. Having it poured into, pouring it into. Until in the beginning it seems to have a clear source. Right? The teacher, the Buddha, the teachings, are the source of the water. But ultimately, you see, there's just water pouring everywhere. And so in Dharma practice, we have glimpses of this, moments of being in the midst of something, something. You know, it happens all the time. People come in and say, they try and describe something that happened, right? And I'm not talking about, you know, Kensho or realizing self-nature, but something happened deep within. And there's a struggle to try and express it. And it can be important to try and express it, but it's actually not that important. Right? The teacher listens because it's important to try and how do you express what's inexpressible? And it also gives insight into what's happening for the student. But ultimately, that's not what it's about. Where is the portrait of the master? Look. Always here, ceaselessly, before practice, within delusion. How can we enter? How can we meet this face? Where is the door? Dadarushi says, listen to the sound of the cold wind in the pine trees. Look at the autumn mountains of green and gold. I remember him saying those words and just being happy. It was so beautiful. I just felt like he had just given me something precious. It was a time like this, but a little further into the season. The mountain was covered in green and gold, and the wind was cold. But it was a time exactly like this. Here and now, mind. Buddha mind, transmitted mind, awakened mind. Bowing in reverence is to manifest Buddha mind. To see the face before your parents arrive. It's to enter into the dragon's cave. Right? You can't just barge in. I'm here, I want something. Tough shit. Right? Go away. You're not ready. Make yourself ready. It cannot be taken by force. It doesn't mean you slide in on your belly. How do we enter? That's what training is. How to enter. So enter that cave, bring peace to what appears to be in conflict. Meet that conflict. Don't rush past. Bring resolve to everything that appears as doubt. Don't be afraid of doubt. Don't rush past. Cultivate patience in every moment where there's anger. Understand the power of anger to train your mind, to open your heart. Let all of those many beings rest. And then enter in more deeply. Go until the light disappears and you can't see your hands in front of your face. You can't feel your feet touching the ground, yet you walk. Go until you can't remember your name anymore. And then go further. Now, listen to the sound of the cold wind in the pine trees. The transmission of the way is not to be found in following after others. If you want to know the truth of the universe, see that the reality of ignorance is not apart from Buddha nature. And the illusory form is itself the pure Dharmakaya. This world is so much more. This world, sitting on your cushion, is so much more than a collection of ideas. than knowing how to get from here to there. This path is really an entry into the soul of the whole thing. And it is alive. And so you have to be prepared to be alive.
Thanks so much for listening. Please join us on October 18th to 21st at Zen Mountain Monastery for A Sudden Flash of Spaciousness, an introduction to mind training with Buddhist teacher and writer Judy Leaf. For details or to find out more about ZMM programs, visit our website at zmm.org.